Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind, WBAI, 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you news, ideas, and concepts to help you lead a more positively minded life. And if this is not the spirit of positivity coming about, you know, I heard in that speech, in the speech he said, do not be joyful. Because to the enemies, he said, don't be joyful. Well, you know, it's a funny thing. The reason, part of the reason we put today's program together was to talk about powerlessness. And it's motivated by the whole concept of political powerlessness that many of us have to face. I noticed a new T-shirt circulating around town that says 12009. You may want to write those numbers down. 1-2009. The new T-shirt is about that would be the last day of the current presidency in office. But between now and then, we got a little time to go. But in that time, today, of course, we heard about Rumsfeld's resignation, or the resignation of Rumsfeld. And something must have happened to your spirit. You know, it must have been confused. You may have said, oh, I think this is a good thing. I think it's a good thing. Even the stock market did not take it as seriously bad. It's like something, there's a little light coming through the cloud. Because before this, what you've had to deal with over and over again was to be faced with two issues that we're going to talk about today. Helplessness and powerlessness. Very important concepts. Very, very important concepts. In the studio with me, Dr. Kent Robert Shaw, fellow thinker. Kent, it's such an interesting thing. I mean, first of all, just nice timing, don't you think?
Oh, it's a joyful day in having the new swing in the world.
Well, don't be joyful.
Yeah, that's what he says. George
don't
says
be joyful, that, yeah. Because you, therefore you're our enemy.
Yeah,
but don't. But it's a joyful day. It's like I've heard people say, you know, it's my first relief. It's the first kind of thing I feel where suddenly it feels like, you know, the elephant stepping off my chest. Mm-hmm. And so today we're going to talk to you about helplessness. Today we're going to talk to you about these two things. Let's talk about helplessness. Let's talk about what to do, what is helplessness, right? Helplessness, a very interesting word, helplessness. Not the same as powerlessness. You would imagine they're the same thing. No, they're not. Helplessness kind of suggests I can't help me and nobody can help me. That's why the word help is involved in there. I can't help me and nobody can help me. So we were looking at this, Kent and I, and we were saying, well, I'll make you a bet there's going to be a whole bunch of things that are related to helplessness and then powerlessness, which is the other end of it. Powerlessness. The sensation of being out of control with no apparent solution to help you regain control. No apparent one. A complete lack of control, you know, over an authority or a status to affect how others will act towards you. So that's another form of powerlessness with people. Or the lack of capability to affect certain results in life, like powerless over illness, death, someone leaving you. How others act towards you. Those are more the powerlessness. So here's our speculation. Our speculation today is that if we were to break most of the psychological problems that people have into two categories, the dark side and the light side, or the anxious side and the depressed side, on the depressed side, we would say helplessness. I can't help me. Nobody could help me. That helplessness kind of bespeaks depression. Whereas anxiety, which is the other kind of way that we feel, some people have both, anxiety is more related to powerlessness. What do you think, Ken?
Yeah, I think that powerlessness involves people's feelings that the world around them, there's nothing they can personally do, that they feel impotent They feel unable to get any power over the things around them that seem to be causing them some kind of pain or some anticipation that something's going to cause them pain. So that feeling of powerlessness, I think, has to do with a personal feeling that that my current situation, and maybe as it relates to anxiety, my future is going to be filled with painful things or frustrating things, and there's nothing I can do to ward off upcoming pain in my life. So I become anxious, I become fearful, I become fretful because I'm impotent about what's coming around the corner that may hurt me or frustrate me or make me feel lesser than.
So in effect, you're not helpless yet because the thing hasn't happened to come and get you. But you're worried that it is going to come and get you and make you helpless. So powerlessness is an anticipation of helplessness.
Yeah. Right. It's an anticipation beforehand of the situation coming up that is going to be causing you some kind of pain. And certainly one of the major feelings of pain is to be stuck in a situation, as you were saying, of depression, of feeling completely helpless, that you yourself can't get out of this situation and there's no solution from the situation and no one around you can also intervene or be helpful. So you yourself can't be helped and there's no one around who seems to want to help or seems to be able to help.
Someone once described depression as the belief that you cannot get someone to love you and the belief that you can never get yourself someone to love you. And therein, you know, shows us the helplessness. Let's take a look at powerlessness and as it relates to anxiety disorders. Anxiety disorders is a category that means you have a lot of nervousness about in one form or another related to something. And let's take a look at a few of them. How would powerlessness relate to, for example, social phobia? Now, what is social phobia? Social phobia is that thing you have when you're afraid to go out in public and you're afraid that you're going to embarrass yourself in front of people. And social phobic people are people who are generally tend to be isolated and very afraid to go to a party or go to a function.
Oh, yeah. I always feel it's some dark combination inside the person of some insecurities that they're having about their ability to be interesting, to be articulate, to be funny, that they're not particularly well-liked, that the people don't find them very admirable or very attractive. All sorts of adjectives that would suggest healthy self-esteem are often lacking in this sense that something bad is going to happen, something painful is going to happen with encounters with people. So that is an anticipation that this future event that's going to take place, I feel powerless about what's going to happen in this party an hour or so from now. I've met many people organizing parties that have that same sense of, you know, will the party be a success? Will people get along? So that same anxiety of, am I going to run a good party, let alone am I going to be well-liked at this party? Are people going to like what I have to say? So I think there's a real core of self-esteem underneath this anxiety and this worry.
It's interesting that you focus on the self-esteem, because what I've always seen in my work with social phobia, Kent, is this one repeated thing. I'm going to get embarrassed. Sure. When they talk about the fear is not like somebody's going to punch me. The fear is I will be embarrassed. Somebody's going to come over to me and do something and I will be embarrassed. And there's always a sense of anticipation of humiliation that goes with social phobia. Do you find that to be true?
Oh, absolutely. I think the shameful experience that people anticipate of feeling, you know, that they in their own eyes and in the eyes of others will be laughed at.
Humiliated,
will be
yes.
Humiliated. Will be seen as less than.
You know, it seems so much like whenever I see somebody who's social phobic, and we're talking about powerlessness, by the way, and social phobia is one of the common forms of powerlessness, why how does social phobia relate to powerlessness? It's kind of clear. I will not. I am taking power over a potential situation, the situation being that I am going to be embarrassed. And I am going to use my power to not get embarrassed, not by going there and being more charming or going there and being better. I will use it by not going. Which reminds me, you know, Kent, of school phobia. Did you ever see a relationship between school phobia and social phobia? Can you see how people with social phobia could easily have had school phobia as kids?
Listen, Armand, I have patients who I treat who every Sunday night around 3 o'clock Sunday afternoon through the evening, and I bet you some of the listeners understand that they have this uneasy feeling. And it's not necessarily...
Sunday night.
It's not that they dread work, but they're starting to anticipate Sunday night, I believe, that tomorrow, Monday, something shameful is going to happen. Something humiliating at work is going to happen. Something tomorrow, it's related to, the adult version of school phobia,
wow,
which is something... with my peers, something with my boss, or that meeting I have to do, or that presentation, something about work tomorrow, I will be revealed as inferior or not very good at what I do. And I see a lot of patients like that on a Sunday night start gearing up with this feeling of anxiety and fear about tomorrow, Monday, and this feeling of powerlessness about tomorrow. What will tomorrow bring with work? Work as it relates to performance, work as it relates to bosses, customers, and peers.
So powerlessness in early childhood can easily carry forward to adult life. We're going to give some more examples of it. For example, what's an obsessive-compulsive disorder? You know, an obsessive-compulsive disorder is you have an unwanted thought. There's a thought in your mind. You don't like it, but it's there. And then in order to deal with this thought, like you have a thought about being dirty, and you can't get this thought out of your mind. So what you do is it's followed by a ritualistic behavior. So get a description of obsessive compulsive, an unwanted thought followed by a ritualistic behavior, and this is fueled by the anxiety that is created by the unwanted thought as being a dangerous thing, you see? So now you have this unwanted thought. You feel like something's going to happen to you. And so you're dirty. You're going to get a disease. And then it's followed by hand washing. And you can't stop because it's doing over and over and over again. And this is, again, the powerlessness over the germs that's manifesting in this particular form of obsessive compulsive disorder. Do you think that the same theory would hold true of powerlessness over the other manifestations of obsessive compulsion?
Yeah, I think, again, we're talking about people with powerlessness. You know, what we're powerless as mortals, right, not as gods, but as mortals, is the future. You know, unless you're Kreskin and you're clairvoyant or something like that, the future social situation we just talked about as something causing fears and anxieties of powerlessness. And now when we're talking about obsessive compulsive, for example, the worry and fear about getting sick. Will I get sick? Am I going to get sick? I'm frightened about it. I'm hypochondriac. I'm constantly thinking I'm going to get sick. I'm worried about getting sick. So absolutely, that worry and fear about will I get sick soon? Oh, germs cause sickness. So yes, if I wash my hands 50 times after I touch something, this feeling of fear and powerlessness about when I will get sick will get relieved a little bit by overly, you know, doing a behavior. People who worry about being broken into, for example, they have another obsessive compulsive disorder of checking things. They check to make sure the stove is turned off 50 times. They check the lock before they leave. So another common way that people deal with their fears, which I would say is a powerlessness over the future about whether my apartment's going to blow up with the gas on or whether someone's going to break in, is I keep checking and checking and checking so that I'm not so fearful that something bad will happen.
Well, Kent, don't you think, though, you know, that in the checking, what the person's really checking and the powerlessness they feel is over themselves. They're afraid they didn't lock the door. They're not afraid of just something bad is going to happen. They're afraid they didn't lock the door. They are afraid that their lack of control, that they left a fire on.
Right.
So this is not so much future that bad things are going to happen because something bad is going to happen. That my inadequacy, my loss of memory, my lack of focus is going to keep me, because remember, people with obsessive compulsive disorders are filled with anxiety. So my lack of focus, which may be based on the fact that I'm so nervous, is going to make me make a mistake. And I'm going to make a mistake, and the mistake I'm going to make is going to cause my house to burn down or something like that. Don't you think that we have this, even fear over health, you know? It's like there's something about me that I'm not in control of. Now, when we talk about addictions and we talk about illnesses, addictions specifically, they're all based on powerlessness. It's all based on feeling like you have no power over your feelings. Isn't that true?
Yeah, I think that there's two levels of feeling of powerlessness. I mean, obviously you have a recognition, or at least a lot of people, the first step of 12-step programs is a recognition of my powerlessness over my own behavior of doing drinking or gambling, that I can't stop myself. But part of the feeling is that the emotions that I'm feeling are very uncomfortable for me, and I need to get control of these uncomfortable feelings.
And that's what we're going to be exploring in a couple of minutes. This is Armand DeMille with Dr. Kent Robert Shore, truncated version of The Positive Mind, because I'll happily give up 10 minutes of every program I have for the rest of my life if I could hear news that soothes my heart as much as the news we heard a little earlier, which is that Rumsfeld has had to resign because he wants to take care of his children. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll resume this.
Outras notas vão entrar, mas a base é uma só. Esta outra é consequência do que acabo de dizer. Como eu sou a consequência inevitável de você. Quantas vezes por aí que falam tanto antes, não, mas não. Já me utilizei. Caem no fim, sou
Pasos to bring us through the sequence. This is Armand DeMille here with you with Kent Robert Shaw. We're talking about hopelessness and powerlessness on an important day here in America. Hey, listen, friends, we're talking about control here, And we're talking about the different things that cause people to feel powerlessness. And there are things that cause one's life to become unmanageable because the person is powerless over these things. People is one. Places, things, situations, and then your own personal behaviors. Now let's talk about the personal behaviors. Personal behaviors, impulse behaviors, a thing you do right away with no pre-thought or hesitation is called an impulse behavior. You go to a store, it's an impulse. You see somebody and you engage in something, you do some drugs, it's all impulse stuff. There's not really much thought or hesitation. And addictive behaviors are a thing you do with no thought at all, which is a habit and out of control. Compulsive behaviors are a thing you do with little thought over and over again, and it's hard to stop doing it. And obsessive behaviors are things you do over and over again because you don't believe it's perfectly done unless it's corrected and modified over and over again. So you get there's quite a difference here. And what are we controlling? Well, you know, when you do an obsessive behavior, you don't really think very much about what you're doing it about. But it just seems that this is all a cover-up. That you're doing, you could be focused on something that's one thing, but there's really another thing that you're trying to control. And Kent, what do you think? What do you think the one thing that people are trying to control with all drugs and addictions and...
And even compulsive behavior, I think, is their. I think it's their feelings and emotions. You know that these feelings and emotions that come over people that are unpleasant. That you know, again, as we mentioned, feeling humiliated, feeling shamed, feeling guilty, feeling frustrated about life. All those complicated emotions are things that people have a hard time getting in touch with why they're feeling them. But clearly a behavior, an addiction, or a compulsive behavior, again, an addiction like let me go gamble, let me go buy a lottery ticket, let me get some ice cream, let me, you know, smoke some pot, or even compulsively cleaning or going through my file system, it'll get me out of that negative emotion that I'm feeling. So it's a way for me to gain power and control over some sense that something's not feeling good inside me.
Most people don't know how to recognize even a negative emotion. But when you think about it, I was thinking about a man I saw earlier, and he said to me, he's powerless with women. And so he's addicted. He's addicted. They look at him and they think he's a sex addict, but it's not sex that he needs so much. He has this kind of addiction to having women and then making love with women and being with women, but he feels powerless. And when we did a little further investigation, we found that as a child, he felt responsible for his mother's well-being. Now, this happens very often to children. Mom says to you, you know, you're making me sick. You made me so happy. She somehow will tell a child, or a father will do this, that they are responsible for the good or bad moods of the parent. Now, what a powerful feeling that is. It is so powerful to believe I could make mommy feel good. I'll do a drawing. And I'll give this drawing to mommy, and then I give drawing to mommy, and mommy looks at it, and she goes, oh, you've made me feel so good. It makes me feel really powerful. But sometimes mommy doesn't feel good, and nothing I do can do it. So now I am both powerful and powerless. But I think it is that double signal that happens to children. If you're good, you make me feel good, and if you're bad, you make me feel bad. That makes kids feel like they get really caught in this powerful, powerless struggle. This man who was addicted to sex, he was constantly trying to make the women happy. And any time a woman would say to him, I'm unhappy, he would suddenly have to bend himself out of shape to do something for them. So I think that is a kind of a, what do you think, Kent, of this idea of there being both, wherever there is powerlessness, there is also power, and that both have to be present for it to be the kind of a thing that really hurts you in some way. You have to both the power and the powerlessness.
Well, I think you're talking about a lot of people's feelings of depression and inadequacy that may, again, link back to, like, social phobia or social anxiety that we talk about. Well, the question would be, well, why do people have this negative feeling that they're not interesting, that they're not have anything important to say? Why is this feeling of lesser than? And you're implying that, you know, a lot of children growing up in households with depressed mothers or family that are full of fighting and divorce and addiction, the child unnecessarily thinks that it's maybe something inadequate with them. To get control of this situation of marital fighting or mother, father addiction or depression or schizophrenia, the child thinks it's something about me. That's a powerful thought for a child to have, but it's a very painful thought because it means something's wrong with me, that my world is so unhappy. There's something wrong with who I am. I'm not good enough. I'm not smart enough. I'm not cute enough. My penis isn't big enough. There's something less than about me, and that's why things around me aren't better. So this, the children's attempt to feel powerful often comes at the cost of them feeling lesser than or feeling bad. You know, I must be bad if these bad things are happening to me.
One of the most beautiful things you ever see is a person who learns to overcome powerlessness. And one of the first steps is to learn to feel entitled to your personal rights. You have the right to live a life free from physical, emotional, sexual, financial mistreatment. You have a right to be treated with respect, to earn a livable income, to be informed of matters that affect you, to express yourself freely. You have this right, and it takes some work for people who don't believe they have these rights, these legitimate entitlements, you know, that you finally get that. And when you finally get that, you could watch a person give up on all these other powerless feelings. I mean, there are things you have no power over. You have no power truly over other people's independent personality characteristics. I mean, you can't, unless you're slipping them Prozac in their orange juice, you can't really do much for them. They are going to be themselves. But most of the frustration that many people feel about relationships is wanting the other person to be different and feeling powerless with that.
Absolutely. I mean, how many people do you run across that will meet somebody, they're dating somebody, they're married to somebody, and they'll have this constant frustration that my wife doesn't like football, or my husband doesn't seem to keep his shoes polished, or something like that. You know, some minor difference where the person is having all this frustration and feeling of powerlessness that this other person continues to be the person I met. You know, they continue to be the adult I met, and surprise, surprise, they're not changing. And so there has to be a healthy recognition that you're powerless over often other people's behaviors and certainly little quirks and warts and pimples about their personality that it hopefully is lovable and endearing if it's just a slight difference.
It's very hard because sometimes when I meet with someone, Kent, I'll try to point out the uniqueness of their partners. And they'll say to me, you know, oh, I love my wife. She's wonderful. She's so creative. She's so energetic. She's so beautiful. She does all this stuff, but she does not clean up the garbage. She doesn't take out the garbage. She doesn't do this work. And I said, if she were the kind of person who did that stuff, tell me how the rest of her personality would change. He said, well, she would be a little more controlled, and he said she would write things down. I said, now I want you to imagine that the very wife you have that you love so much is turning into a person who organizes everything. How would you like that? And he said, well, it sounds like a really good thing, he said, but then she wouldn't have the spirit that I love so much. And that's the point. A lot of times we just look at whatever's nearest us and we try to control it. Sometimes you want to control your cat or your dog well, don't try to control a cat. That's impossible. You control your dog, right? And you want to control them and you want to keep some kind of control over them, and it makes people feel better because they have a pet they can control. Do you ever see men walking down the street with two Doberman pinschers? Mm-hmm. Pinchers, I wonder what they're doing, you know? They walk around with these two dogs, big giant dogs with spike collars around their necks. And it's like a flaming sense of inadequacy coming in your direction. Here's a person who's controlling two dogs, and that makes them feel good. And I'll bet that attracts a lot of people to sports and things, you know, like controlling race cars, controlling jumping out of airplanes, all of these things that we do that are an effort to not accept the fact that there are just some things we can't do anything about, number one. And number two, there are some things we'd be better off not trying to change.
Sure, just accept people, again, accepting people for their warts and pimples, to me, relates to a feeling that I have warts and pimples, and we all do, that you just have this sense of humility that, you know, I have my imperfections, the person I'm with has these imperfections. But I think a lot of people, they want to spend a lot of time with their children and their friends and their spouses about trying to fix them, you know, and again, an area where you would think a sense of healthy powerlessness about, I can't fix, and Al-Anon would say change, control, correct another person. But a lot of people waste a lot of time worrying about and thinking about changing other people, rather than, obviously, as you and I as therapists, you know, the only person you can change, I guess Michael Jackson said this, is the person in the mirror. You know, that people's energy should be, well, as we talked about, people's addictions, people's compulsions, people's behaviors themselves, inside themselves, that maybe need a little attention and a little bit of fine-tuning.
There are a few questions I would ask myself. In order to admit your own powerlessness, you need to recognize what is causing your life to be unmanageable. Like, what is unmanageable, and what are you trying to spend your time trying to manage? So if you take a look at it, you might make a note of some of these. Ask yourself, what is problematic about this thing? So let's say you have a child who's acting out in some way. What's problematic about it? Why is it problematic for you? Now, that's an interesting question to answer, because sometimes you look at the problem, meaning somebody else's problem, and you don't realize that it's really a problem about you. Like if you say, my child does not do his homework, what's the problem for you? The problem for me is that I'm afraid that I'm going to be looked at, criticized, that the child's going to give me more problem in the future, but it's more of a personal fear. Our next question is, why is it causing your life to be unmanageable? Because, you know, and you have to look at it and say, do I put too much effort into this? How come there's two different people who have the same child, you know, a child with a similar kind of problems, and one of us get crazy about it and the other one doesn't? What efforts have you used in the past, or are you currently trying to use to correct it? We frequently don't think about the fact that we're trying certain things. Why have your efforts to solve, change, or control this thing failed in the past? How do you feel about your lack of success at solving, controlling, or changing this? Think about your husband. Think about, oh, you know, or your mate or your child or even your own illness. You know, let's say you have a problem with an addiction and you've tried so hard and you've tried to stop smoking. What have your efforts to solve, change, or control failed to this point? How do you feel about your lack of success? You know, it's a thing that happens as you get over 50 years old. You look back at some of these struggles that you've had that you just haven't succeeded at, that you tried so hard but you couldn't beat them, attitude that you might have, choice that you might make. So when you think about how it's affected you, you know, how the failure at controlling has affected you, it's very important to be able to accept that feeling of, oh, man, I wish I had. Whose help? Whose assistant? Whose support have you enlisted to solve the problems? And one of the things you're going to find is in almost every problem you ever solved, there was somebody there solving it with you. It could be a group, it could be friends, it could be a therapist, but almost, and what you're going to find is the problems that continued to exist usually didn't have the same support system as the ones that don't exist anymore. But that's a good one to think about. Think about something in the past over which you've had no power that you have power over now. Can you think of anything? Think about it. did you have no power over cigarettes? Remember being able to try to, I couldn't quit. You remember not being, did you ever try to quit cigarettes? Did you try to quit cigarettes?
Sure, I used to smoke.
Yeah, and you tried to put them down and then you wound up picking them up again? Because at some point, some time ago, you said, I don't think this is good for me. Right? Not knowing how bad it was, but you tried to give it up. Well, think about the fact that you did and what that means. And what are the things have you controlled? Have you controlled your rage? Remember how outraged you used to get, how judgmental you used to get? Remember how serious it was that you used to get, how seriously you would consider problems? Remember when a small thing became a crisis instead of a big thing? You know, and how you used to see things as much bigger than they are and you used to worry about them much more? Part of helping yourself change is to look back at your successes that you've had. We rarely think about them. We think about only the failures that we've had. To what extent is it an uncontrollable or unchangeable event in your life, this thing that you're trying to get control over and change? What if it's something like you've got terrible health condition and there's nothing you're really going to be able to do about it? Or you just had a fire in your house and you lost your house. Why have you not let go of the unchangeable, celebrated those that you've changed? Why have you not done that? Well, that's one. Once you identify your problems, then identify the thinking that will keep you from admitting to yourself that your problem, you're powerless to solve these problems on your own. You know, you got to get some kind of help with it. You just got to. I can't tell you how many people I've seen come by, and I know, Kent, this is what people come to you for a great deal. It's really not that you do so much as a shrink, but the fact that they have come to you and support your help or enlist your support, that's what really makes the difference. I think it's the relationship. Don't you think they're reaching out and saying, I have no power?
Yeah, absolutely. And just the act of connecting with somebody is an action step that seems to be one of, I think something can help. As we were talking about the depressed place, which is nothing can help. I feel helpless and no one around wants to help. So just the action step of going to therapy or going to some kind of support is a step that suggests there is help and maybe there are people who want to help, whatever pain I'm feeling.
And sometimes the help is no help at all. They're just there. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, let's say you're somebody who decided to give something up and you went to therapy or you went into a program and then you got off the program. Then you binged, you did something, you broke. Mm-hmm. There's something so important about knowing that if you tried something and did not succeed at it, that you just get right back on the horse. Okay, yeah, you know, it's like one of the beauties of AA meetings is you walk in and after having binged overnight, they're not going to judge you. They're not going to say when you walk in and say, I'm on day one. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody kind of gets it. Sure. Sure, so you had a lost weekend. We're not going to beat you up. We're not going to yell at you. We're not going to scream at you. Sure, that's the way it works. Part of the way all change works is with a significant amount of recidivism. You know, you're just going to go back. You're going to fall off. You're going to do it wrong. You promise yourself you're going to love your wife better. And then you treat her or you mistreat her again. You promise yourself that you're going to be kinder with your children. And you wind up screaming at them. It's all right. It's all right. Don't make your major apologies. Don't look for forgiveness. Make as much amends as you can and go back. Start all over again. Because powerlessness is a perception that keeps us caught in a structure, in a struggle that's unending. It just won't end. The powerlessness struggle is going to be one that's going to make you crazier and crazier and crazier. You get to relate to no one. You don't get to love yourself. The point at which you give it up and you try and forgive yourself, look at your strengths as well as your weaknesses, that's the part where you start to grow. And that's where you start beginning really believing that you're a person worth saving. And I think that's where it finally goes, you know? Ask yourself that question in the depth of your despair. Are you worth saving? Does anybody care? Will you save yourself? I think that's what's important. Dr. Kent Robert Shaw, once again, I want to thank you for thinking with me.
Always my pleasure.
You know, Kent, I love sitting here on this very interesting day. We're going to be back with you tomorrow. Candace Pert, you know who Candace Pert is? She was in What the Bleep Do I Know, and she was, you know, she's a molecular biologist. She's going to be with us tomorrow. It promises to be a very positive, interesting, at least, experience. So a little something special for you, since the Rolling Stones just passed through town. The Rolling Stones had a concert at the Beacon Theater, a one-day concert, would you believe? And they did it because they were doing a filming for something. So I heard this, and it made me think of all of you. If you want to send me an email, it's armand@brainlink.com, or you could go to thepositivemind.com. You could reach Dr. Kent Robert Shaw the same way, through the website, thepositivemind.com. I'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends. Yeah.